This is the EO Podcast. Entrepreneurs Organization proudly presents the EO Virtual Learning Podcast, designed for all entrepreneurs with a hunger for learning how to better their business and themselves. I'm Dave Will, an entrepreneur and the host of this podcast. I'll be talking with guests that have a story of interest to entrepreneurs. The content of each episode is centered around getting to know the guest and hearing their story. I encourage you to try to find one thing in this podcast to help you better your business or yourself. Listen and enjoy. Cedric Waldberger, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
It's really fascinating having you. And there's actually two things about you that I find fascinating. One is, I think, what drew me to invite you to this podcast, which is the fact that you don't have a home. You're traveling with, quote unquote, 64 items, mostly black, that you're taking with you around the world. Essentially, you live out of a suitcase. You're a self-proclaimed, not a minimalist, but an essentialist. And so that's one of the things. The other thing is you're a tech startup coach and many times startup entrepreneur. So those are some of the things I wanted to talk to you about. But there's a let me introduce you a little bit better than just that. You're the co-founder of several startups, including Media Design. You're a serial startup expert. You coach with a lot of folks about startups. You're originally from Switzerland. But it sounds like over the past 2 years, you've taken on this little adventure of traveling around the world with 64 items. And that's all of the items in your possession. Actually, I'm very curious. I've got some questions about that, obviously. Most of these items are clothing. Most of them are black. You're living out of the suitcase. You have a couple statistics that I saw on your Facebook page. 3.7 days on average in each place. 200 flights in the past 2 years. You've circled the globe 11 times, I'm sure, in the distance that you've traveled in the past 2 years. I mean, first of all, let me ask the question that I think you probably hear a lot. Why are you doing this? Is this a publicity stunt? Are you trying to draw attention? Is this something, obviously, maybe it's something you really sincerely enjoy is the travel, but are you going to these extents to draw attention, so to help drive the rest of your business? I mean, what is the motivating factor behind taking this to such extreme levels?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. I'll take a step back. I co-founded or I started my first company without even knowing that it would turn into a company back then when I was 14. And that was even before I started my studies. And,
that's Media design.
Yeah. And early on in my life, I realized that I'm very passionate about those first 24 months of a business. So that process, when it's all about going from an idea that we had at the bar last night to a business that does 1 million, and 1 million could be a million users, a million packages shipped, $1 million in revenue. But I've become kind of obsessed with that process of going from idea to 1 million. And I decided I wanted to expose myself to as many case studies or companies in that phase as possible. And I've done that by co-founding companies. I've joined companies early on as a CTO, co-founder, or consultant in some cases. And then about 3 years ago, I started to invest in companies as well and coach them along the way. And I just realized that Zurich is not exactly a tech startup epicenter of the world. And first, I've lived in a few places around the world before. I've had a bit of a network in Berlin and the European startup space. So it just came naturally that I started to spend more and more time in Berlin. And then after that, I also got involved with businesses overseas. And at some point, I realized that sometimes it was kind of holding me back from spending the right amount of time with one of those businesses, just because I still had a place here in Zurich, or I had a car here, or I just felt obliged to stay in a location because of some things, some stuff, instead of spending the time with the company and people I valued most, or where I thought it would have had the most impact. And so about 3 years ago, I started to reduce the amount of stuff I owned, because I realized that the less I own, or if I only own essential stuff that I can always carry with me, I will have the same quality of life everywhere in terms of like the physical stuff that I have access to. And then sometime mid last year, I gave up on my apartment because I realized that I don't really need it if I'm only spending a few days a month in that apartment anyway. And I'd rather be completely free and liberated from anything physical that held me back until this point. I think that's, in a nutshell, why I'm reducing the amount of stuff that I own and trying not to be dependent on any physical constraints with when I'm thinking about who and what company to spend time with.
All right, so let's pick this apart for a second. So you're living in an apartment. You've got all the things that people that live in apartments have. You have coffee tables and couches and lamps and TVs and utensils and dishes and plates. All those things, I can easily see how you'd get rid of those. But then there's these things in our lives that are sentimental. You know, whether it's art or letters from people that were meaningful to you, or photographs. What did you do with these kinds of things? Did you digitize them? Did you put them in a box and put them in storage somewhere? I mean, do you still own things that have sentimental value to you?
So to your last question, the short answer is no. I don't own anything where I have that has emotional value to me. So I don't really care about the stuff that I have. But I think it's important to understand that this was a long process for me. Like, I moved away from Switzerland for the first time about 7 years ago. And since then, I've always spent no more than 6 to 9 or 12 months in the same location. So just by that lifestyle, I got used to not being able to bring stuff with me. Like, even though 7 years ago, I moved with like 3 or 4 large bags when I moved to New York for the first time. I think over time I realized that I never go back to these things anyway, and I don't really miss them. I did digitize most of them. I have a lot of pictures. I keep them all on Google Photos, where it's easy to search them and bring back kind of like visual reminders of memories. But other than that, there's not a whole lot that I keep that was physical and is now digitized.
All right, so 200 flights in the past 2 years. First of all, where are you right now? I think you said something about being here in Switzerland. So you're in Switzerland now, is that right?
Yeah, I'm in Zurich right now. I wouldn't even say that Zurich is my home anymore, because like even here I stay in different places all the time. But I'm just here for, I think, 3 days to work with one of the companies here. And then I'm going to be in Berlin next, and then back to the US for a few days. In the places that I've lived before or where I have friends, I tend to stay with them for 1 or 2 nights, not because I couldn't go to an Airbnb or hotel, but because it gives us some extra time. Like, I've started to really enjoy these, let's say, the last 2 hours of the day where you wouldn't necessarily go out again and meet someone for a beer. But if you're staying with someone, it's like it's actually really good quality time to talk to them. And I think that has led to a lot of interesting conversations over the past 9 months since I've started or since I've given up on my home, where I crashed with friends in Zurich or Berlin. And as I said, like, you don't necessarily schedule another beer at 10 p.m. of the night. But if you're staying with them, it gives you an extra bit of time to talk to them. And so that's usually my first priority for a day or two. If I don't have friends in a place, then there's usually two options, apartments from Airbnb or similar platforms, or hotels. And I tend to stay at hotels for short visits, 1 or 2 day visits in a place. And then for longer visits, I usually go to an apartment, because it allows me to wash my stuff and get a bit more privacy. And I also like to cook while I'm on the road every now and then, just because I enjoy being home and like working and cooking and getting a bit of quiet time sometimes.
Let me cut to something that I was curious about right from the get-go. This sounds like something you do when you've fallen into a fair amount of money, because I think a lot of people think, yeah, this would be cool. That'd be fun to travel around. Let's assume I don't have a wife and kids or a job that I have to go to. And most of the people listening to this, I would suspect, are entrepreneurs. So we have a little more freedom and flexibility in our career path. But where do you get the money? I mean, if you look at each trip, say 200 trips a year, let's say the flight, and I suspect many of the flights are more than $500, but let's say the flight plus travel plus, you know, an Uber or a place to stay or food, you're looking at probably, say, $500. And I think that's a low estimate, but you tell me, $500 per trip. You add that up over the course of 200 flights, it's somewhere around $100,000 to travel around in 2 years. It's not a ton of money, but I'm curious, where do you get the money from? Where is this coming in from? Media design? Are you working along the way? Talk to me about that.
So I think the number is a bit lower, just because a lot of the, I try to not go between continents all the time. Not just for financial reasons, but because it's also a lot more tiring to switch time zones too often. And you can fly within Europe or within the States for a bit less than I think the average that I spend on a flight is probably more in the $150 to $200. But nevertheless, it adds up. So I think the 100 flights per year, that's like 50 round trips. So it adds up to probably like $10,000, $15,000 in flight costs. You just look at that as one number, it sounds like a lot. But then if you compare it to not having an apartment, like there's also a few thousand dollars that I save each month just by not having an apartment in Zurich. It's not that high of a number. And then, of course, there's some trips I pay for because the startups are not generating any money. Some of the startups or my engagements are paid, so I get to expense the flights and hotels. So it's a mix of those two.
Interesting. So, talk to me about your revenue stream though. Where do you get your money from? What's your primary source of income right now?
Right. So I do a bunch of stuff. I'm working with 14 different projects right now. Everything from very early stage companies that I just co-founded a few months ago to investments that I've been running over the past few years. I'm still involved with MediaSign, which has been running for more than 10 years now. So it's a bit of a some here, some there. Like the younger companies that do not make revenue are not profitable yet. I usually work for free with those. And then other ones that are more established, like MediaSign, they pay me for part of my work or for my hours. I think for me, and it's probably the same for a lot of entrepreneurs, I try to make enough money month to month to have a comfortable life or to not worry about money. And I'm now in the fortunate position that's the case. But I find it way more interesting to bet on the long term, to bet on the investments that I've made that are hopefully going to turn out to be profitable or sell at some point. And then, of course, my own businesses, I'm trying to take as little money out of them as possible in order to maximize their long term chances for success.
All right. So I'm going to drill down now a little bit into the list of items that you have. And in fact, if you go to, let me see if I've got this right. I'm going by memory here. Cedric Waldeberger, that's CedricWaldeberger .ch/64things.
Yeah, okay, 64 so, as a number and then things, okay. T-H-I-N-G-S.
So if you go there, it'll take you to a Google Doc, which shows a spreadsheet of literally the 64 things you have, how much they cost, and what color they are.
Yeah.
And so I noticed here, I was scanning through this list, and I found a few things kind of interesting. Number one, one of your 64 things, in other words, one of the 64 most important things to you is a bow tie. Not just a bow tie, but then you also have a regular tie. Cedric, I'll tell you right now, I have far more than 64 things. I must have in the thousands, tens of thousands of things, if you include my kids and my wife. And we have one bow tie in the house and it's not mine. So I'm curious. And not only that, but you have a suit vest as well. Not just a suit, a sports coat that you put on, but you actually have a suit vest. So I'm curious, how did these two things make the top 64?
So when I started to reduce, I've always told myself that I don't want to miss out on any important events or experiences in my life just because I've given something away or just because I restrict myself to having a certain amount of items or carry them around in a suit, in like a small carry-on. And there's just sometimes you want to go to a wedding, sometimes you want to go to a nice event where you want to dress up, and that's why I kept those items in my life. There's also the other item that kind of fits into that list of the bow tie and the suit vest is a white shirt, which is one of two remaining items that are not black on my list. right. Yeah, that just, I mean, I just didn't want to ever be in a moment where I feel like I cannot go to a wedding or I cannot go to this gala dinner or whatever because I didn't have the right attire with me.
So some of the things that did not make the list, a jacket. And I guess when you need a jacket, you find a jacket, right? You just, you have friends that have jackets. Hey, can I borrow a jacket on my way out today? Or, I mean, so, or you have a sports jacket, I guess. Maybe you can wear that if you're feeling cold. I mean, do you have sweaters or sweatshirts or what? I'm sure you've been in some cold areas.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially here in Switzerland, it gets cold and Berlin, it gets cold quite often. My thinking was that I have, four different layers of merino wool. Which I can like onion technique style put on and take off to kind of regulate the temperature. But I gave up on a jacket, because I realized that the moments where I'm outside and I'm, in the rain or, in the snow where I really need a jacket that like, protects me against a wet environment are really not that many. And if they happen, they're usually planable. Meaning if I know I'm going to go hiking tomorrow in the mountains or if I'm going to go skiing or snowboarding, I usually have the time or I have access to friends or my family who can borrow me or I can borrow a jacket from them. Mm-hmm. And it just took up way too much space in my carry-on.
I hear you there. I know. I'm a runner and I find that whenever I go somewhere, I like to travel light myself, at least on trips. But it's difficult to do when you need your running gear, whether it's running shoes, socks, if you're in a cold area, you got my running underwear, which is thick protective underwear. You know, you have the long pants, a running jacket. So again, this is if I'm running in winter territory, but I noticed that it's one of the things you said is you have a routine, a daily routine where you wake up in the morning, you do body weight exercises in the morning and at night. You also have a low sugar diet and you don't drink alcohol. Is that right?
Yeah, I just drink pure water, like water, still water.
Nothing else. No coffee. No
juices. No coffee. I think I've had a single cup of coffee in my life. So I never got addicted.
Good for you. So, and then the fitness, you seem to put a lot of value on the waking up and getting your blood flowing and doing the same before bed.
Yeah, I think what really convinced me to, so what I do is I get up, I immediately do a body weight exercise, workout of about 15 minutes. And then I take an ice cold shower or I go swim in the lake and that kind of like kickstarts my day. And then I do, something similar at night. I do a 15 minute workout. Cold shower, and then I go to bed and the lights go off.
I'm sorry, why a cold shower?
I've just realized that that's a really good way to kickstart my day. Like, even if I haven't had enough sleep or even if I'm a bit jet lagged, like it really wakes me up. And because I've been doing this for more than several years now, every day, it doesn't feel as cold, but I think it still triggers the same chemical reaction in my body where I feel kind of...
Yeah, or you could try a warm shower and a cup of coffee. Just a thought. You know, I don't want to have be a negative influence on you, Cedric. But so let's go back to something. Speaking of showers, let's talk about hygiene for a second. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This is also based on memory. But as I after I shut down that spreadsheet, I was saying, wait a minute. I don't think I saw toothbrush, toothpaste, deodorant, medication. Are these things that are on the list? Maybe I just missed them.
So I don't put anything on the list that I would recycle within less than 4 weeks, let's say 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
So, toothbrush and deodorant, I carry them with me. There's like the casing for all my, toiletries. It's on the list, but not the toiletries themselves.
What is your technology of choice? I mean, you're a tech savvy guy. You're a startup guy, tech startup guy. So what do you travel with? What's the technology that's meaningful to you?
I just try to get the tools that allow me to be most productive. For me, it turns out that's a fast Apple laptop, and an iPhone. Beyond that, I've given away my Apple Watch. I don't have my iPad anymore that I use to track my sleep, my steps. And I also use it as a watch.
What'd you say? A Fitbit? Is that what it was?
Yeah, Fitbit. And then I also use, and this is especially helpful during travel and being productive on planes, I, I have some Bose headphones, noise canceling headphones. If you haven't tried them, they're a life changer. Like, they're quite expensive. They're about $250 if I recall correctly. They're in-ear headphones, so you can sleep with them quite comfortably. And they allow me to just step on a plane, put them in, and shut off the environment and relax on planes. Even if there's a crying baby like two seats behind you, that's usually not too much of a disturbance with those headphones.
Well, maybe you've got a sponsor there if you feel this strongly. I mean, you're getting quite a following around this essentialism. So tell me for a second, what's the difference between essentialism and minimalism? Because I've heard you describe yourself not as a minimalist, but an essentialist. What's the difference?
I think that minimalism is all about getting to the least amount of stuff. Having only 15 items is better than 200 items or 64 items. And that's not something I aspire to. Like, for me, less is not necessarily more. For me, it's more about keeping only the essential stuff in my life, the stuff that really gives me value, the stuff that's there for me and not the other way around, not stuff that I need to spend time with or that holds me back. And so I call it essentialism because I think, or I want to reduce the amount of stuff I own to the essentials, the stuff that gives me value, the stuff that makes me happy, the stuff that allows me to be the best version of myself. And I don't want to restrict myself by going below that number. And it could also mean that if you're someone who likes to collect, I don't know, CDs, in my opinion, it's perfectly fine to own like 200 things or 500 things or 1,000 things. I think the important question, or I think the healthy question, is to ask ourselves every now and then, is this stuff really there for me? Does it provide value for me? Or is it the other way around? And I just, I spend a lot of time maintaining all this stuff and it's draining energy from me.
Let's go down that path for a second. I'm 46. I've got a house that we're actually building onto right now, and we're building a garage. We've never had a garage before. We're building a garage. I guarantee that's going to be filled with bikes and skateboards and scooters and paddleboards and pretty much just about everything you can imagine. In our basement, we've got, it's wall to wall with stuff, just stuff. I mean, we've got three kids. 16 years of Christmases has gone by with relatives bringing gifts and giving gifts. And so here's my question. I wanted to set the stage. Here's my question now. Somebody like me hears this, and I think there's no doubt in my mind that the volume of stuff in our lives has become a burden. What do you recommend for, again, this is for somebody with a wife and kids and actually a house and no desire really to pick up and leave and be in other places. I like where I am. It's time to purge. Do you have recommendations, or is that not really something you've given thought to help other people get to the point where you're at?
I can tell you about the systems or techniques that I've used and still use in order to find out what I think is essential for me, like the process of how I define to keep a bow tie but to let go of my jacket. And the first question I would ask myself is, does it bother me having so much stuff? And if it doesn't bother you at all, you're free in your decisions and stuff is not keeping you back, then maybe there's no need to change, right? But you said that you feel it's time to purge. So system that I've used, I call this the 1990 rule, is that about every 3 months I look at the amount of stuff that I have and I go through it and I ask myself, have I used this item in the last 90 days and am I going to use it in the next 90 days? So by asking those two questions, I basically cover half a year, and half a year is a long time. That usually covers most of the situations that you'll ever get in within a few years. It means you'll be in some cold environment, you'll be in some warm environment, you'll go to some casual events, formal events, and so on. And if there's an item that you cannot say yes to any of those questions for, meaning you haven't used the item in the last 3 months and you're not going to use it in the next 3 months, then I suggest you put it in a bag, store it in your garage or somewhere where it's not, where you don't walk by daily. And then 3 months later, go back and see if you've used any of the items. And my experience was that I've never used any of those items that I tend to put away for those 3 months. But I felt that it's emotionally much, much easier to not purge them right away, but to store them somewhere where I don't see them in my daily life. And then 3 months later, I've kind of justified to myself that I'm never going to use it again because I haven't used it in the last 90 days.
So there's a book, a really interesting book, I think. And gosh, I'm not going to get this right, but I'm hoping you might know the name and clarify it for us. The Art of Getting Rid of Stuff, or The Art of Purging, or something like that. But and I'll have to find it and put it in our show notes. Does it ring a bell, the book I'm talking about?
It doesn't. No, I was just Googling.
It's something I'll be able to find it a little later. I don't want to distract. I don't want to get too distracted from our conversation right now. But it's a book that this woman wrote, essentially answering the question that I just asked you, is how do we simplify our lives? And her suggestion is just to focus on one area at a time. I love, and then you go into it with that mentality that you had, the 90-90 mentality. I think that's a great approach. And what I like about it is you can adjust it as you'd like. You know, maybe I want to say 6 months forward, 6 months back, I cover a 1 year span. That might work as well. But so I love that philosophy. Let me ask you a hypothetical.
Sure.
And before I do, I'm going to get there through a little bit of a story. I know you listened to Tim Ferriss's podcast. Did you listen to the podcast with Tim Ferriss and Cal Fussman?
I think I did, yeah.
So Cal Fussman, I think this was one of my favorite Tim Ferriss podcasts, the one with Cal Fussman. Cal Fussman is an interviewer. He's interviewed Muhammad Ali, some of the political figures, Ronald Reagan, Gorbachev, the names of the people that he's talked to has just been off the charts, world-class figures. And he described his life when he left the first magazine he worked for, but I think because they shut down, he decided he was going to go to Europe for a little while. This is a guy that I think it was in New York City, decided he was going to go to Europe. He calls his mom and he says, "Hey, Ma, I'm going to go to Europe for a little while, try to figure things out before I come back and get another job." 10 years later, he finds his way back to the States. And for 10 years, Cedric, for 10 years, if you remember this podcast, and he's a phenomenal storyteller, for 10 years, he traveled the world and he really didn't have a destination in mind. He'd go to a train station and say, "Hey, where's the next train going?" He'd get on that train and he'd travel. And on the train, God, I could go on and on telling this guy's story for him. But on the train, he would then find somebody that he'd get to know and talk to and ultimately figure out how to get invited back to their place so he could have a place to stay for the night. So that was his philosophy. Now, one day he was on a train and he met a beautiful woman down in South America. And he met a beautiful woman. Normally he would pass the beautiful woman because he knew that generally speaking, he would not be invited to go home with them. So he'd always look for the old ladies, the grandmas, you know, and talk to them about cooking and soup and goulash. Well, one day he actually did talk to this beautiful woman and they ended up getting married. And that was the end of his travels as a solo single man. So since then, he's created a different life for himself. So the very long-winded question is, hypothetically, you meet somebody that you want to settle down with, somebody that doesn't necessarily have the desire to be an essentialist, the desire to be up and about every single day. And in fact, they have this desire to have you around and start to make some babies maybe, or start to find a home and build a niche in an area. First of all, let me ask you this. Is that something that you see could happen to you?
So first of all, I have to say that's the best and greatest intro I've ever heard to that question. Usually people get to the point a lot quicker. So
yeah, no, I'm not very good at getting to the point very quickly.
No, that was fantastic. So my philosophy is this, like, I want to make the best out of my life and continuously reassess what that means. What does make the best mean? So I have this process where also every 90 days I have like personal OKRs and I try to so what I do is I see my life as in 12 different areas and I write about them. So those 12 areas could be friends, family, it could be financial success, it could be health and fitness. And I have this list of these 12 areas and I send an email to myself in the future, meaning the next 90 days, at the end of each quarter. And I write about how happy I am and what I want to change. And I do that to become very conscious of how I feel about these different areas of my life. And whenever I see that something comes up twice, meaning 90 days ago I said I should travel less because I feel let's say I've met someone and I should spend time, or I should spend more time with that special someone. And I realized 90 days later that I didn't adjust my lifestyle, or I didn't make the right choices to make that happen. I'm kind of disappointed with myself, and I try to take action immediately. Now, that happens very rarely, because I think the whole process of becoming conscious about what you want and not running after stuff that stands between what you actually want and what it may look like. So to give you an example, what I mean is, like, you probably, no one on earth wants a fancy car just for the sake of having a fancy car. I mean, I get that there's car enthusiasts and stuff like that, but or people like that, but very often what we are looking for is more friends or more love in our life and whatnot. And we think that we're going to get that by reaching certain milestones, which could be like owning a car or a fancy car or something like that. So I try to be very conscious with my decision and my lifestyle. And to answer your question, if I meet someone, and I've been in relationships over the past few years, when I meet someone, I make adjustments. I find ways to be in one place more often if that's what we both want, if we want more time together. But at the same time, I'm probably, at least in this phase of my life, I'm probably not someone who is happy spending afternoons on the couch. And so usually the people, or if I meet someone who fits that kind of profile, like, it usually doesn't work out way before my frequent travel becomes a problem.
So we have a mutual friend, Ari Mizell and Nick Sonnenberg. I've had them on the podcast recently. And in fact, I think Ari was one of my very first interviews as well, over a year ago. And they're productivity specialists. And it sounds like that's a real passion of yours. Ari has a book, a couple books out, actually. One is Less Doing, More Living. The other, The Art of Less Doing. Now, you're working on, your latest startup is sendtask.io, sendtask.io. Tell me about that startup, and what is it that's unique about that business?
So over the past few years, I've started to work with many different teams at the same time. My investments, MediaSign, and the companies I've built earlier on, and consultancy projects. And I've learned the hard way that time is very scarce, and there's never enough time to get all the stuff done that you should get done in a day if you try to get to 100%. And so I've made it my challenge to become really good at applying the 20/80 principle. So finding out which are the things that I actually need to get done to get the maximum output with a restricted amount of input, which is time. I'm a huge fan of productivity tools. I've tried tens, if not hundreds, over the years. And there's one thing that I've always missed. I think there's a lot of actionable information in our life, and actionable information usually is tasks. So you would ask me to do something. I would ask you to do something. I would ask a team to provide something. There's a lot of great tools to work in that fashion and assign each other tasks if you're in one and the same team for most of your time. There's Asana, Trello, Teamwork, lots of other solutions, Basecamp. And they're all great tools, but they're all kind of restricted by this organizational property, meaning that you need to create an account, and usually there's one workspace. And it's kind of a closed entity, the area that you work in and where you collaborate. And I've been looking for a long time, but I couldn't find a tool that allowed me to, instead of sending emails to people, I could send them tasks. And sending them tasks has the benefit of, instead of them replying to me, hey, I'm not going to get this done, or me chasing them, I can automate that. So they can change the due date of a task. They can change the assignee. They can comment on a task. So it allows you to track these atomic items of actionable information, where if most of us, or even I still fall back to email every now and then, and I send someone an email containing some tasks. And my experience is that it never gets to 100%. It always, if an email contains five items, two get discussed, one gets done, and two are completely forgotten. So with Zendesk, we've built a system that offers you all the power and benefits of these Asanas and Trellos of the world, but with an additional benefit that you can share tasks with anyone as long as you know their email address. And the recipient doesn't need to have an account in order to use that system.
So what is the, I'm curious, what's the revenue model for Zendesk.io?
So we're just starting out. We just released our first version, kind of an MVP, about a month ago. And it's fully functional. We have daily users now, but we're at the very beginning. So revenue is not the main goal right now. First, we want to build a great product that people like, and we want to make the chore of completing tasks a lot more fun and friendly. In the long term, there will probably be a freemium model where you can use the app to a certain extent for free. But let's say if you are a power user and you upload a lot of attachments, maybe that's something you will pay for, or will go and talk to corporates and allow them to set some additional security features, or allow them to control access rights in a certain way. I think there's plenty of opportunities, but right now we just focus on building a great product that's free to use and hopefully makes the life of a lot of people more stress-free than it is right now.
So Cedric, I see you as kind of a swashbuckler. I see you as this guy that's hard to tie down and get into a meeting. What is your role in this company? What do you do?
So in this company, I'm the CEO. By heart and by profession, I'm a software developer. I studied electrical engineering and then computer science back in the day. And that's why this project was why I really wanted to get started with this, because it allowed me to go back and start coding again. And so about 6-7 months ago, I started to work on the first prototype. By now, unfortunately, I'm not doing much coding anymore. We have a team of six now, mostly designers and developers. And I'm the CEO. I try to make sure everyone can get work done.
So with a product like this, I mean, certainly the technology is one piece of it, but I would argue it's almost secondary. But let's not get in the argument whether it's first or second. Another equally important, or very, very important part of a company like this, and I'm speaking from experience, I'm building a platform with my partner called PropFuel. And PropFuel is recognition and feedback software for small businesses. Now, the technology is really important, but the other piece of it that's critically important is marketing and inbound marketing, creating content to draw eyeballs and attention, because the whole idea of building it so they will come just does not happen. So what are you doing from a marketing perspective? How are you getting the word out there about this product?
I think there's two things. First, we're going to write about, so our company, the six people that I mentioned, our small team, it's fully distributed. So no one, there's no office, there's no two people in the same location. For a fact, we've worked together with one of the developers. I've worked for more than half a year before I first met him last week, actually. So we're going to write about how the 21st century enables you to really follow your own rhythm and be very creative and get your best work done every day just by allowing this very flexible company structure. I think that's one way that's interesting and hasn't been tested too often and written about. But then the second channel, which we hope will be way more effective just by the nature of its product. If I can convince you to use Zendesk, and you go and try it out and you like it, and maybe you'll start using it for your own tasks at first. But then, because there's no barrier to invite other people, we hope that you are going to share Zendesk with your coworkers and even friends, because it makes it so easy to get stuff done. It's so much better than sending an email to your friends. If, let's say you're for something casual, like planning a trip, you could send out an email to your friends and ask who's going to rent the car, who's going to book the flights and stuff like that. But you'll see that it's so much easier and rewarding if you do it in Zendesk, because it automatically reminds people. It just gives you peace of mind that stuff is going to get done. And so this built-in virality this built-in share functionality is what we hope will drive traffic in the long term.
So I can see this goes hand in hand with the theme of your life, of this freedom and this sense of focusing on the core element of not only what you want to have with you, but the core element of how to get things done. I mean, you're, in a nutshell, you're a productivity expert.
It's definitely something that I'm very passionate about. And I think it goes in line with what I mentioned at the beginning, that I'm just so passionate about how do you turn an idea into an actual company or product? And how do you decide not to turn an idea into a product or company? How are you efficient about that, about saying no to an idea or opportunity? Yeah, I think that's kind of the quest of my life, or what I want to spend the next 5, 10, or 15 years on, and figure out how to really nail that process.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about, and this comes down to simplifying and being more process-oriented. When you have 200 flights you're booking over the course of 2 years and places to stay and so on, what tools do you use to book those flights? Do you have an assistant, or do you pretty much do it all yourself? And how do you do it efficiently?
Yeah, I have a virtual assistant. He's in Macedonia, Skopje. So he's about 2 hours by flight away. So it's not someone on the other side of the world, but he's we have never met until last week as well. Last week I got to meet him after working with him for more than a year, and like collaborating with him almost daily. So I think that's a huge productivity boost, having someone who helps me organize and take care of flight bookings and stuff like that, so I can take care of the more creative tasks. Thing is that I try to build systems for everything that I've done at least three, or like that I've done the same way three times or more. So I document a lot of what I'm doing, like expensing stuff, or like expense receipts, stuff like that, or simple stuff like how do I decide which flight to take from point A to point B. I have a system for that with, like, I've outlined the tools, I've outlined which kind of class to book, business class versus economy, in which case, which seats to check me into once check-in and boarding becomes available. So I just try to get a lot of the systems that are in my head down to paper, and then I put them either in a Google Doc, or I create send task checklists, so that I can just go back to those and assign them to someone, and they know exactly how to perform each and every step.
So you just described exactly the mentality that Ari Mazel and the team at Get Leverage proposes. And Get Leverage is the virtual assistant program that Ari and Nick have set up. Where did you find your virtual assistant?
So whenever I hire someone, I have this process. I think it's about 5 steps. The first step is that I write a very extensive proposal, or like job description. And it covers both. It covers attitude. So how do I want you to think, and what should your attitude be? And the second part is, what should your skills be, your background, and what's the kind of work that you're going to be doing? And I try to be very concrete with those so that people have a good understanding. And somewhere in that job description, it's usually about a 2 or 3 page document, somewhere in that job description I put a small remark that says, if you're interested in this opportunity, then start your application with exactly this line, and they will say something like, hey, Cedric, I'm the rock star virtual assistant that you're looking for. And then I just put that on as many channels as possible. And it's anything from social media, Twitter, Facebook, to Upwork, freelance, and my personal network. And I get a lot of responses for something that's broad, like virtual assistant. And because I put this one-liner that they need to get right somewhere in there, I get a very quick feedback if they actually took the time to read the proposal carefully. And that usually cuts down to about 15 to 20% of the responses. And then as a second round, I send out the Google form that has questions again about your attitude and about your skills. So if I'm looking for a developer, these might include, I'll ask for your Myers-Briggs type, and I'll ask you to describe your favorite riddle or stuff like this. And then the skill part will be a few technical problems. And then I'll send that out to the remaining 15 to 20%. And usually I get about maybe like a remaining 5% or 3% get back to me within the deadline or before the deadline. And then I have my virtual assistant go through the first few questions about attitude and see if they fit the criteria. And the criteria might be for certain jobs, like proper English skills or did the candidate take enough time to give a long enough answer? And that usually cuts it down to, I don't know, maybe like 30 to 50. And then I give it to someone who can give me feedback on the skill side of questions. And they give ratings, so they give numbers between 1 and 5. And that gives a total number for each of the remaining candidates. And then I choose the top three, which are usually superstars by this point. And I send them a test task, which is another briefing that's like 2 or 3 pages, and it gives them enough work for about 2 days. And when they send in the solution, that's when I, for the first time, I pick up the phone and I talk to them and I ask them why they did stuff the way they did it and how they think about the job. This allows me to hire people very efficiently, and like usually it takes less than 2 hours of my time to hire an additional person just because of this system. And I can pick from a very large pool of applicants.
Yeah, you're a very, very process-oriented person, which of course becomes a real asset when you're living life the way you are. The one thing I thought was really interesting is your process of weeding out the vast majority of the applicants, which was to give them very specific instructions. Hey, start your note to me with this phrase. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but back in the 80s, I think it became very well known that the Van Halen rock stars would put in their contracts that they only wanted green M&Ms in their dressing room. And so, of course,
it's kind of funny.
Well, so they get a reputation for being just prima donnas, and you know, how dare they take advantage of people like that and be such jerks all around. But actually, the mentality behind this was not because they only wanted green M&Ms. They weren't being prima donnas. They weren't being jerks. What they were doing, or actually what their manager was doing, was ensuring that the people that were responsible for the contract were actually reading the contract. Because if they read the contract, they would see in the fine print in there that they required green M&Ms in their dressing room. If there were not green M&Ms in the dressing room, it told them that they did not read the contract, and therefore they would pull out of the show, or they'd at least have some information that they need to go through the contract in greater detail. So it sounds like, without even realizing it, you took on the same philosophy of giving a very specific instruction in order to weed out the people that didn't read your instructions. Well done. All right, Cedric, I think that covers it. I actually went to sendtask.io, and it looks fantastic. I'm looking forward to giving it a shot. I also did find the book that I was referring to in my Kindle. It's called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing, and it's by Marie Kondo. I've heard good things about that book. It's one of these things that I downloaded and I have yet to actually read, but I got it. And I may read it one day, but I've heard very good things about it. If you're like me and you have far too much stuff and it's just time to purge. Cedric, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. You're a very interesting person, and I'm looking forward to continuing conversations with you. I'd love to pick your brain and share notes on starting up a new business, as I'm working on my second software business, and this one's much different from the first one. So I'd love to reconnect with you on that point.
Anytime.
All right, Cedric. Great, great talk. And thank you very much.
My pleasure. Talk soon.
Thanks for listening. For more great content or to learn about Entrepreneurs Organization, go to www.eonetwork.org.